Chapter 34. Finding words that, after what had passed between them, should seem neither false nor heartless. And at last she exclaimed, standing up, "Poor little Juliet! Can't I go to her? Juliet is not here. I left her at St. Raphael with the relations with whom my wife was staying." "Oh," Lizzie murmured, feeling vaguely that this added to the difficulty of the moment. How differently as he had pictured their meeting. "I'm so sorry for her," she faltered out. Deering made no reply, but, turning on his heel, walked the length of the studio, and then halted vaguely before the picture on the easel. It was the landscape he had begun the previous autumn, with the intention of sending it to the salon that spring. But it was still unfinished, seemed, indeed, hardly more advanced than on the fateful October day when Lizzie, standing before it for the first time, had confessed her inability to deal with Juliet. Perhaps the same thought struck its creator, for he broke into a dry laugh, and turned from the easel with a shrug. Under his protracted silence, Lizzie roused herself to the fact that, since her pupil was absent, there was no reason for her remaining any longer, and as Deering again moved toward her, she said with an effort, "I'll go, then. He will send for me when she comes back?" Deering still hesitated, tormenting the cigarette between his fingers. "She's not coming back, not at present." Lizzie heard him with a drop of the heart. Was everything to be changed in their lives? But of course, how could she have dreamed it would be otherwise? She could only stupidly repeat, "not coming back? Not this spring?" "Probably not, since our friends are so good as to keep her. The fact is, I've got to go to America. My wife left a little property, a few pennies, that I must go and see to for the child." Lizzie stood before him, a cold knife in her breast. I see, she reiterated, feeling all the while that she strained her eyes into impenetrable blackness. "It's a nuisance, having to pull up stakes," he went on, with a fretful glance about the studio. She lifted her eyes slowly to his face. "Shall you be gone long?" she took courage to ask. "There again, I can't tell. It's all so frightfully mixed up." He met her look for an incredibly long, strange moment. I hate to go," he murmured as if to himself. Lizzie felt a rush of moisture to her lashes, and the old, familiar wave of weakness at her heart. She raised her hand to her face with an instinctive gesture, and as she did, so he held out his arms. "Come here, Lizzie," he said. And she went with a sweet, wild throb of liberation, with the sense that at last the house was his, that she was his, if he wanted her, that never again would that silent, rebuking presence in the room above constrain and shame her rapture. He pushed back her veil and covered her face with kisses. "Dee, don't cry, you little goose," he said. 3. That they must see each other again before his departure, in some place less exposed than their usual haunts, was as clear to Lizzie as it appeared to be to Deering. His expressing the wish seemed, indeed, the sweetest testimony to the quality of his feeling, since, in the first weeks of the most perfunctory widowerhood, a man of his stamp is presumed to abstain from light adventures. If, then, at such a moment, he wished so much to be quietly and gravely with her, it could be only for reasons she did not call by name, but of which she felt the sacred tremor in her heart, and it would have seemed incredibly vain and vulgar to put forward, at such a crisis, the conventional objections by means of which such lickspist existences defend the treasure of their freshness. In such a mood as this one may descend from the passy omnibus at the corner of the Pont de la Concorde, as he had not let him fetch her in a cab, with a sense of dedication almost solemn, and may advance to meet one's fate, in the shape of a gentleman of melancholy elegance, with an auto taxi at his call, as one has advanced to the altar steps in some girlish bridal vision. Even the experienced waiter ushering them into an upper room of the quiet restaurant on the Seine could hardly have supposed their quest for seclusion, to be based on sentimental motives, so soberly did Deering give his orders, while his companion sat small and grave at his side. She did not, indeed, mean to let her private pang obscure their hour together. She was already learning that Deering shrank from sadness. He should see that as he had courage and gaiety to face their coming separation, and yet give herself meanwhile to this completer nearness. But she waited, as always, for him to strike the opening note. Looking back at it later, she wondered at the mild suavity of the hour. Her heart was unversed in happiness, but he had found the tone to lull her apprehensions, and make her trust her fate for any golden wonder. Deepest of all, he gave her the sense of something tacit and confirmed between them, as if his tenderness were a habit of the heart hardly needing the support of outward proof. Such proof as he offered came, therefore, as a kind of crowning luxury, the flower of a profoundly rooted sentiment. And here again the instinctive reserves and defenses would have seemed to vulgarize what is trust ennobled. But if all the tender casuistries of her heart were at his service, he took no grave advantage of them. Even when they sat alone after dinner, with the lights of the river trembling through their one low window, and the vast rumor of Paris enclosing them in a heart of silence, he seemed, as much as herself, under the spell of hallowing influences. She felt it most of all as she yielded to the arm epicently put about her, to the long caress he laid on her lips and eyes. Not a word or gesture missed the note of quiet union, or cast a doubt, in retrospect, on the pact they sealed with their last look. That pact, as she reviewed it through a sleepless night, seemed to have consisted mainly, on his part, in pleadings for full and frequent news of her, on hers in the assurance that it should be given as often as he asked it. As he had felt an intense desire in it to betray any undue eagerness, any crude desire to affirm and defend her hold on him. Her life had given her a certain acquaintance with the arts of defense. Girls in her situation were commonly supposed to know them all, and to use them as occasion called. But Lizzie's very need of them had intensified her disdain. Just because she was so poor, and had always, materially, so to count her change, and calculate her margin, she would at least know the joy of emotional prodigality, would give her heart as recklessly as the rich their millions. She was sure now that Deering loved her, and if he had seized the occasion of their farewell, to give her some definitely worded sign of his feeling if, more plainly, he had asked her to marry him, his doing so would have seemed less like a proof of his sincerity than of his suspecting, in her the need of a verbal warrant. That he had abstained seemed to show that he trusted her as she trusted him, and that they were one most of all in this deep security of understanding. As he had tried to make him divine all this in the chariness of her promise to write. She would write, of course she would. Booth would be busy, preoccupied, on the move. It was for him to let her know when he wished a word, to spare her the embarrassment of ill-timed intrusions. Intrusions? He had smiled the word away. You can't will intrude, my darling, on a heart where you're already established, to the complete exclusion of other lodgers. And then, taking her hands, and looking up from them into her happy, dizzy eyes, colon, you don't know much about being in love, do you, Lizzie? He laughingly ended. It seemed easy enough to reject this imputation in a kiss, but she wondered afterward if as he had not deserved it. Was she really cold and conventional, and did other women give more richly and recklessly? She found that it was possible to turn about every one of her reserves and delicacies, so that they looked like selfish scruples and petty pruderies, and at this game she came in time to exhaust all the resources of an overabundant casuistry. Meanwhile, the first days after Deering's departure wore a soft, refracted light like the radiance lingering after sunset. He, at any rate, was taxable with no reserves, no calculations, and his letters of farewell, from train and steamer, filled her with long murmurs and echoes of his presence. How he loved her, and how he knew how to tell her so. She was not sure of possessing the same aptitude. Amused toward the expression of personal emotion, she fluctuated between the impulse to pour out all she felt and the fear lest her extravagance should amuse or even bore him. She never lost the sense that what was to her the central crisis of experience must be a mere episode in a life so predestined as his to romantic accidents. All that she felt and said would be subjected to the test of comparison with what others had already given him. From all quarters of the globe she saw passionate missives winging their way toward Deering, for whom her poor little swallow flight of devotion could certainly not make a summer. But such moments were succeeded by others in which she raised her head, and dared inwardly to affirm her conviction that no woman had ever loved him just as he had, and that none, therefore, had probably found just such things to say to him. And this conviction strengthened the other less solidly based belief that he also, for the same reason, had found new accents to express his tenderness, and that the three letters she wore all day in her shabby blouse, and hid all night beneath her pillow, surpassed not only in beauty, but in quality, all he had ever penned for other eyes. They gave her, at any rate, during the weeks that she wore them on her heart, sensations even more complex and delicate than Deering's actual presence had ever occasioned. To be with him was always like breasting a bright, rough sea that blinded while it buoyed her. But his letters formed a still pool of contemplation, above which she could bend and see the reflection of the sky and the myriad movements of life that flitted and gleamed below the surface. The wealth of his hidden life, that was what most surprised her. It was incredible to her now that he had had no inkling of it, but had kept on blindly along the narrow track of habit, like a traveler climbing a road in a fog, who suddenly finds himself on a sunlit crag between blue leagues of sky and dizzy depths of valley. And the odd thing was that all the people about her, the whole world of the Passy pension, were still plodding along the same dull path, preoccupied with the pebbles underfoot, and unconscious of the glory beyond the fog. There were wild hours, when she longed to cry out to them what one saw from the summit, and hours of tremulous abasement, when she asked herself why her happy feet had been guided there, while others, no doubt as worthy, stumbled and blundered in obscurity. She felt, in particular, a sudden urgent pity for the two or three other girls at me. Clopin's girls older, duller, less alive than she, and by that very token more appealingly flung upon her sympathy. Would they ever know? Had they ever known? Those were the questions that haunted her as she crossed her companions on the stairs, faced them at the dinner table, and listened to their poor, pining talk in the dim-lit, slippery-seated salon. One of the girls was Swiss, the other English. The third, Andora Macy, was a young lady from the southern states who was studying French with the ultimate object of imparting it to the inmates of a girls' school at Macon, Georgia. Andora Macy was pale, faded, immature. She had a drooping southern accent, and a manner which fluctuated between arch audacity and fits of panicky hauteur. She yearned to be admired, and feared to be insulted, and yet seemed tragically conscious that she was destined to miss both these extremes of sensation, or to enjoy them only at second hand in the experiences of her more privileged friends. It was perhaps for this reason that she took a wistful interest in Lizzie, who had shrunk from her at first as the depressing image of her own probable future, but to whom she had now suddenly become an object of sentimental pity. Ivy. Miss Macy's room was next to Miss West's, and the Southerners knock often appealed to Lizzie's hospitality when me. Clopin's early curfew had driven her boarders from the salon. It sounded thus one evening just as Lizzie, tired from an unusually long day of tuition, was in the act of removing her dress. She was in too indulgent a mood to withhold her omen, and as Miss Macy crossed the threshold, Lizzie felt that Vincent Deering's first letter, the letter from the train, had slipped from her loosened bodice to the floor. Miss Macy, as promptly noting the fact, darted forward to recover the letter. Lizzie stooped also, fiercely jealous of her touch. But the other reached the precious paper first, and as she seized it, Lizzie knew that as he had seen whence it fell, and was weaving round the incident a rapid web of romance. Lizzie blushed with annoyance. It's too stupid, having no pockets. If one gets a letter as she is going out in the morning, as he has to carry it in her blouse all day. Miss Macy looked at her with swimming eyes. It's warm from your heart, she breathed, reluctantly yielding up the missive. Lizzie laughed, for she knew better. She knew it was the letter that had warmed her heart. Poor Aunt Dora Macy! She would never know. Her bleak bosom would never take fire from such a contact. Lizzie looked at her with kind eyes, secretly chafing at the injustice of fate. The next evening, on her return home, she found Aunt Dora hovering in the entrance hall. I thought you'd like me to put this in your own hand, Miss Macy whispered significantly, pressing a letter upon Lizzie. I couldn't bear to see it lying on the table with the others. It was Deering's letter from the steamer. Lizzie blushed to the forehead, but without resenting Aunt Dora's divination. She could not have breathed a word of her bliss, but she was not altogether sorry to have it guessed, and pity for Aunt Dora's destitution yielded to the pleasure of using it as a mirror for her own abundance. Deering wrote again on reaching New York, a long, fond, dissatisfied letter, vague in its indication of his own projects, specific in the expression of his love. Lizzie brooded over every syllable of it till they formed the undercurrent of all her waking thoughts, and Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.